All right, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'd like to welcome you to class this morning. If you look, you have notes in front of you for lesson 113, titled The Dispensational Covenantal Rift. And some interesting things that we have to cover. Before we get started, I just want to let you know something. The information that I'm going to give you, I came by relatively recently. Last month I had a dinner date with Dr. DeWitt, and we discussed some different things. Among them was this essay, or notes from a speech that had been given by R. Todd Mangum, titled The Dispensational Covenantal Rift. You probably don't remember this because we've looked at so many different things, but the book, one of the books that we used for Schofield was co-written by Mangum and Sweetum. And so this guy has done some work in some other areas. But so the information I got on this is relatively new to me, and I came by it just about a few weeks ago, but with enough time to include it into the class. So if you look at your notes, the first point is titled The Dispensational Covenantal Rift. And I just want to go through this and say a few things about it. So in 2007, Dr. R. Todd Mangum wrote a book titled The Dispensational Covenantal Rift, The Fissuring of American Evangelical Theology from 1936 to 1944. On November 19, 2010, Dr. Sweetum presented a lecture to the Dispensational Study Group of Evangelical Theological Society of Atlanta, Georgia. So that's a mouthful for you. So this is a copy. I don't have any extras of this. However, I can make them available electronically online. This is a copy of the speech that that Mangum gave on the 19th of November 2010, summarizing some of the key points that were in his book that he wrote 3 years earlier in 2007. So the title of the speech is The Dispensational Covenantal Rift, How It Happened, Why It Happened, and Can It Be Repaired? Okay? So you've got some things here that are interesting that you need to know about with respect to just the history of dispensational theology in the United States in general. So to finish point one, in this lecture, Mangum addresses the issues that led to the Presbyterian Church in the United States to formally renounce dispensational theology in 1944. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's one major denomination that officially came out against dispensational theology, and that is the Presbyterian Church in the United States, and that's what we want to look at here by considering these notes this morning. Now, you should know, though, that those of the Reformed tradition, or the, shall we say, the Calvinistic tradition, had already been doing things to renounce dispensational theology previous to this. We've already studied how Harry Bultimo was kicked out of the Reformed Church. We've studied how Martin DeHaan was kicked out of the Reformed Church. But we also looked at how C.R. Stamm's father, Peter Stamm, was also kicked out of the Reformed Church, all related to issues for their beliefs in dispensational theology in general. So, point two, toward the beginning of his lecture, Dr. Mangum points out that many of the patriarchs of American dispensationalism were Presbyterians, also noting the connection the denomination had with Dallas Theological Seminary at the time of its inception. James H. Brooks, C.I. Schofield, Lewis Berry Chafer, Everett Harrison, Roy Aldrich, John F. Walford, J. Dwight Pentecost, and S. Lewis Johnson. In fact, Dallas Theological Seminary, the capital of dispensational theology, was originally conceived as largely a Presbyterian school, though officially it was always interdenominational. When Dallas Theological Seminary was founded in 1924, and throughout its early years, Presbyterian students and faculty were predominant. So, just before I get too far ahead of myself, look at the next point. Mangum quotes the work of John Hanna, the author of An Uncommon Union, Dallas Theological Seminary and American Evangelicalism, and the seminary's Christian or church historian to prove this point. Quote, while the seminary was officially non-denominational, the majority of its faculty in the 1920s, the general focus of its teaching, and many of the students were Presbyterian. Speaking of the faculty, Chafer noted in 1925 that they were almost wholly drawn from Southern and Northern Presbyterian churches. On another occasion, he stated, the simple fact is that we are teaching the most conservative Presbyterian interpretations here, and we include on our faculty now 7 Southern Presbyterian ministers. Perhaps the Presbyterian nature of the institution is most clearly captured in the assertion, it, referring to the seminary, stands on the great vital truths embodied in the marvelous document, the Westminster Confession of Faith. That's coming from Lewis Sperry Chafer to D.S. Kennedy from the 23rd of October, 1924. So, if Dallas Theological Seminary is viewed as sort of the early mecca of dispensational theology in the United States, it's important to know that in its inception and through its early history that the majority of the faculty, as well as the majority of the students, were all coming from Presbyterian churches, either from the North or from the South. So, this early connection between dispensationalism and Reformed Presbyterianism theology helps explain the generally Calvinistic cast of most dispensational theology and virtually all of American dispensational theology originally. It also helps explain why the debate between dispensationalism and covenant theology has sometimes been characterized by such animosity. It is at its root a family feud, according to Mangum. So what he's doing here, you understand what he's doing. Okay, he's acknowledging that there's a great many of the original patriarchs of dispensational theology in the United States were all from the Presbyterian denomination. That including Lewis Sperry Chafer, who founded Dallas Theological Seminary. Now, there's an interesting chart here that he presents that I was unfortunately not able to digitize. But what you have here is the denominational affiliation in these graphs of Dallas Theological Seminary graduates between 1925 and 1995. And this dark line is Presbyterian. So you can see here through the early years of the school that the predominant denomination that made up the faculty was Presbyterians. I'm sorry, the student body was Presbyterians until you get to the year 1945, and then you see a major decrease in the number of Presbyterian students that are attending Dallas Theological Seminary. Okay? Then he also presents a similar chart for the faculty of Dallas Theological Seminary between 1925 and 1995. And you can see that in the early years of the school, the early decades, that the vast majority of the faculty of the school was overwhelmingly Presbyterian. Until, guess what year? 1945. So something happens in 1945 that is going to alter the perception of Dallas Theological Seminary amongst Presbyterian American Presbyterians. Okay? So top of page 2, dispensationalism was deemed heterodox, or not in accordance with established or accepted doctrines or opinions, especially in theology, or unorthodox, by an official committee of the Presbyterian Church in the United States in 1944. The committee of renowned scholars within the Presbyterian Church researched their decision primarily by investigating the writings of C.I. Schofield, maintaining the Schofield Reference Bible, and Lewis Sperry Chafer, then president of Dallas Theological Seminary. So, understand what's going on here. 1944, the Presbyterian Church of the United States sets up a committee to investigate dispensational theology. Okay? As the committee goes out to investigate dispensational theology, they consider 2 primary sources for their consideration. The first one is the Schofield Reference Bible, and the second one are the writings of Lewis Sperry Chafer. We've already gone over this information. You should know by now that Chafer was taught by Schofield, and that Chafer was the founding member, if you will, of Dallas Theological Seminary in the 1920s. Then Chafer writes his multi-volume systematic theology that seeks to state in academic terms the theology of the Bible Conference movement of which Schofield was a part. So when this committee in the Presbyterian Church is going to go out to investigate dispensational theology, The two documents that they consider are, number one, the Scofield Reference Bible, and number two, the writings of Lewis Berry Chafer. So Chafer, who was still alive during the investigation and verdict, believed and maintained that the Presbyterian Church's decision was the result of a liberal conspiracy against him, when in actual fact, it was the most conservative members of the Presbyterian Church that were responsible. Mangum reports that the covenant wing of the Presbyterian Church started the confrontation, thereby taking the dispensationalists by surprise. A major reason why the dispensationalists were attacked was because they were so successful at propagating their views. So you need to understand that I'm just going to abbreviate this. Within the Presbyterian Church, there are basically two factions. One of them is dispensational. The other one is covenantal. Okay? Because of the success of Dallas Theological Seminary, the popularity of the Scofield Reference Bible, the activities of Lewis Berry Chafer, dispensationalism, as we've already gone over and already studied, was increasing in popularity. Okay? The covenantal wing of the Presbyterian Church did not like this. And so what they do is they order this official investigation into the matter. Now there's some other things here that we got to look at, but that's a summary of what's going on here. So if you look at the indented bullet point, quoting now from the speech, by 1930, the Scofield Reference Bible had achieved 1 million sales. The first ever Oxford University Press publication to do so. I find that to be amazing. The first Oxford University Press book to reach 1 million in sales was the Scofield Reference Bible. Okay? A little known fact is that it was largely sale of the Scofield Reference Bible that enabled the prestigious Oxford University Press to survive the Great Depression. So without the sale and publication of the SRB, it's very likely that they may have folded during the Great Depression. That's how popular and how many of these they were selling. That notwithstanding, many scholars at the time were galled that the prestigious Oxford Press would stoop to lend its credibility to a work they regarded as less than credible at best. So, the hoity-toity academic elites are looking down their noses at Oxford Press for even daring to publish something such as the Scofield Reference Bible, because they viewed it as beneath them and theologically suspect and not in line with the Westminster Confession of Faith and that sort of thing. So scholars and professors in seminaries regularly, and I'm going to say this word wrong, pilloried it and urged people not to use it. So if you were going to a theological seminary, an institution of higher learning during the 30s, early 40s, there you would have gotten nothing but that they were running down routinely the Scofield Reference Bible amongst the academic elites within these denominational schools as being ridiculous and, you know, not of any value and not scholarly and all that sort of thing. But like a blockbuster movie whose ticket sales continued to climb, however much the critics skewered it, the Scofield Reference Bible continued to be bought, used, and cherished by ordinary church folks across denominational, racial, and class divides all over the United States, Canada, and Great Britain. Many an average pastor or Sunday school teacher found the notes and cross-reference helps of the Scofield Reference Bible a true godsend. Folks, this just leads me to point out once again the disconnect that often exists between the academic elites and the ivory towers and the everyday average Christian going to church, church-going Christian, you know, who's going about his daily life the way we all do, going to work, having to take care of things. One of the things that the Scofield Reference Bible provided was a collection of information in a single volume that would have cost hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars to amass if you had to go buy all the books individually that were used to produce it. But we've gone over all that stuff already. So according to Dr. Mangum, financial pressures caused by general trends within fundamentalism may have raised tensions between Dallas and the denomination. Dallas was founded in the mid-1920s with the goal of training preachers, teachers, professional clergy, and lay leaders in theology and ministry approach of the Bible Conference movement. This was the movement from which the Scofield Reference Bible and Scofield and Schaefer themselves had come. These schools likewise found a market of students and began drawing conservative, evangelical, and fundamentalist students from numerous denominations. At Dallas Seminary, primarily from Presbyterian denominations. This was right at the time when the denominational schools were suffering great financial hardship. It was not long before denominational leaders began to notice that schools with, quote, dispensational ideas were draining people and resources from their own denominational works. So guess what that means? Time to do what? Time to attack them, time to criticize them, all right? So, any questions so far? I'm kind of flying through these so far. Any questions about any of this background information? All right, top of page 3. The defining moment in which covenant theologians came in force against dispensationalism was in 1936. This was the year in which the new, quote, pure Northern Presbyterian denomination was formed under the title Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Now, I did not want to get into all the nitty-gritty of Presbyterian history, okay? But there were disputes between modernists and fundamentalists and so on that we've already seen within the Presbyterian Church, and some broke off and began this new Presbyterian Church called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Up to that point, conservatives in the Northern Presbyterian Church, frankly, were willing to tolerate a lot. It was once they separated that they became more insistent on a narrow set of doctrinal convictions and became more intolerant of differences. Shortly after the Orthodox Presbyterian Church had been formed in 1936, a dispute over dispensational premillennialism erupted. It all began with the publication of 3 sets of articles, all written by Westminster Seminary professors, all from the perspective of traditionalist Presbyterianism. All 3 argued that the establishing of a true Presbyterian church meant repudiating any intrusion of anti-reform teachings, specifically Arminian and dispensationalist teachings, which were too commonly found in the general evangelical fundamentalist movement. Taking up a different aspect of this one central thesis, each article sought one common objective: to establish a truly Reformed, truly Presbyterian identity over and against a less vigilant one. So, Westminster Theological Seminary starts to come out and say, dispensational theology is against what? It's against the Westminster Confession of Faith. And therefore, it is not a truly Reformed, it is not Reformed enough, it is not true Presbyterianism for any Presbyterian to be adopting or holding dispensational beliefs within the denomination. Now, does everybody understand what's going on here? Okay? So where this is all leading to is ultimately an official action on the part of the Presbyterian Church in the United States to speak out or come out against dispensationalism. So contained within this fight was an attempt to separate truly Reformed viewpoints from unreformed viewpoints. J. Gresham, is it Mahan?
Machen.
That's how you say that?
Machen.
Along with others, tried to delineate from acceptably Reformed premillennialism and the unacceptable or heretical version of premillennialism typified by the Scofield Reference Bible. Okay, so now remember, there were 2 types of premillennialism. There was historicist premillennialism, and there was dispensational premillennialism. Okay? What
What's his name again?
Machen.
What Machen is advocating for, when he's talking about acceptably reformed premillenarianism, is that historicist or historical premillenarian version. And what he is saying here is unacceptable or heretical is dispensational premillennialism that is typified by the Scofield Reference Bible. In the end, this unacceptable brand or unreformed brand of premillenarianism was labeled dispensationalism. Tensions mounted within the Orthodox Presbyterian Church between the amillennialists and premillennialists until June of 1937, when several Presbyterian premillennialists split. So here's our secondary split from the OPC to form the BPC. So they're offshooting, fostered the impression among the, quote, truly reformed, that the only way to maintain premillennialism was to redefine the Westminster Confession to accommodate the view, thereby creating a splinter group. Now, all right, so let me just try to... So we start off with this group here, okay? Breaking off from this group is the OPC, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. These guys have a disagreement in their midst between historical premillenarianism and dispensational premillenarianism. Okay? These guys eventually are going to break off from that group and are going to form the BPC, or yet another church. Okay, another denominator, another splinter group of the Presbyterians. So what happens then is these guys adopting a more dispensational premillennial view are viewed then as leaving or abandoning the Westminster Confession of Faith, and the only way they can form this new group is to abandon the fundamental, the formative document of the Presbyterian Church, which was the Westminster Confession of Faith. So these guys are going to be ultimately labeled what? Heretics within the Presbyterian Church because they are adopting which version of premillennialism? Dispensational premillennialism, and again, this is typified by the SRB, Scofield Reference Bible, which they think to be what? Heretical. Okay? Now everybody with that. Okay, if you're not, you're just not saying, so we'll...
The initials BPC, what's that saying? What's the Bible Presbyterian? Oh, no, Bible Presbyterian. Oh, that's Carl McIntyre's group.
Yes.
So they split off from this group, okay? And what's the guy's name again? It starts with an M?
Machen.
He's the guy that started this group. He split off from these guys thinking that they were getting too... Actually, he split up from the Northern Presbyterian Church of the United States, thinking they were too liberal and not fundamental enough. And he forms this group in roughly 1936, and they have their own internal argument between historical premillennialism and dispensational premillennialism, which means this group splits off following or subscribing in majority to the teaching of Scofield and the SRB, and these guys are viewed as heretical by those guys. Okay? Everybody with that? So, which point are we on?
There was a man named Carl McIntyre that largely head up that Bible Presbyterian. Remember, he had the big radio broadcast, and it was a large movement. He finally moved his whole operation out into 3 miles off the coast, so they couldn't touch him. I don't know whether you remember all of that.
I didn't want to get into the...
Yeah.
Down and dirty of Presbyterian history, but beyond what was necessary to follow our general theme of the history of dispensationalism in the United States. Okay, thanks. One lesson learned by Southern Presbyterian leaders as they scrutinized the Northern controversy was that troublemakers, whether modernists or fundamentalists, could be identified by their attitude, now this is important, toward the church's doctrinal statement, the Westminster Confession of Faith. So any modernist or any fundamentalist could be measured where they were at, judging them by the measuring stick of the Westminster Confession of Faith. Once the fundamentalists severed themselves from the modernists, Southern Presbyterian leaders took note that it was the premillenarianists who had to separate again and adjust the Westminster Confession of Faith to accommodate their view. And to make matters worse, the premillennialists seem to have a nasty habit of splitting Southern Presbyterian churches and carrying off the membership to their independent organizations. To a Southern Presbyterian, few actions could be considered less Christian or less Presbyterian. Okay? So this is all going on in the North. Meanwhile, the Southern Presbyterian Church is watching this, like I just said, they're watching this BPC split off and adopt dispensational premillennialism and saying the only way they're getting there is to redefine the Westminster Confession of Faith to make it fit what they want to believe. Oh, and oh, by the way, these guys are the troublemakers because they're going out and splitting churches by teaching this, and therefore they're not real what? They're not real Presbyterian, and they're behaving in ways that are unchristian and unpresbyterian by behaving in this particular fashion. Okay? Any questions about that? In the estimation, bottom of the page, in the estimation of Southern Presbyterians watching the fighting of their Northern brethren, dispensationalism was viewed as the cause of these splits. It was the Presbytery of North Alabama that lit the powder keg when they asked the Southern Presbyterian General Assembly to investigate whether or not dispensationalism was in accord with the Westminster Confession. In response, an ad interim committee on changes in the confession was formed to investigate the matter. So, now we have an official committee of the denomination being formed to investigate whether or not dispensational theology is in line with the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, you need to understand, they're not investigating whether O'Hare or Stamm or whether Mid-Axe dispensationalism is in line with the Westminster Confession of Faith. They're primarily focusing on what would be called, let's just say, standard or traditional dispensationalism as explained in the Scofield Reference Bible and also by Chafer. So, it was this, top of page 4, it was this ad interim committee on changes in confession that reported to the General Assembly that dispensationalism was out of harmony with the Westminster Confession of Faith. To this day, this action remains as close to an official denunciation of dispensationalism by a reformed covenantalist body that has ever been produced. While the Confession Committee was merely advisory to the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly, their findings were published as an official judgment of the officers of the Church, both in church papers and in a separate pamphlet published by the Executive Committee of Religious Education and Publication. The credibility of the committee's report is witnessed by the fact that its criticisms of dispensational theology has been maintained by covenant theologians ever since. So there's a nuance here, okay? These guys that are on this committee, the authority they have is to investigate it, okay, and then come back and report to the General Assembly. So they do that, and what ends up happening then is that their report gets published and put out and printed in the publications and so forth of the denomination. But what never actually happened is that the General Assembly never actually took up the matter to give an official declaration on the matter from the point of view of the General Assembly. So what ends up happening is that the findings of this committee become the accepted ruling of the Southern Presbyterian Church with respect to dispensationalism, and they find it to be out of step and out of favor and out of bounds, if you will, of or with the Westminster Confession of Faith. So that becomes then their position. So And their silence on the matter is then viewed as an official what? An official proclamation against dispensational theology. Okay, now, that was a mouthful, yes.
We ran into that exact thing personally. We were attending a covenant church when we met Otto Deming, and when we started having studies with him, the pastor told us he was a heretic, and we were to promise not to study with him anymore. Well, obviously, we didn't listen. What a blessing if we didn't. You know, but it was a covenant church, and that's exactly what their stand was.
Before my father became the pastor of Berean Grace Church in Genoa City, Wisconsin, there was a family in that church who had raised their son, you know, sitting under different Grace pastors, Dick Ware, Ted Fellows, other people that had been in the church there in Wisconsin, and they went there the entire time up through when he graduated high school and went on to college. Well, he went on to college and went to Bob Jones University. And when he gets to Bob Jones University, he meets a girl that he, you know, falls in love with and everything, and she attends the Southern Presbyterian Church. Well, lo and behold, it's not long before he's coming home and telling Dad how everything that he learned growing up is heresy, and quoting and referring to the findings of the committee here. Okay? So yeah, this becomes a big deal. That's one of the reasons why I'm spending time to talk about it, okay? Because this is the closest that an official denominational body has ever come on a church ruling regarding dispensational theology, okay? And you have to understand it in a nuanced sense, because the General Assembly actually never voted on it, but they published the findings of the committee, which then became viewed as their what? Their stance, okay? Any other thoughts on that before we move on? Craig, you look like you want
to. I just think it's kind of funny that they don't really give much thought into if it's in harmony with the Bible or not. They're all worried about this Westminster Confession of Faith. And, you know, that's kind of a fundamental problem. I
think. The Calvinistic tradition is definitely very creedal in their approach. So, halfway down the page, significantly, the Confessional Committee declared dispensationalism an aberrant theological system, not because of its premillennialist eschatology, but because of its deviation from the covenant theology of the Westminster Standards. And just to underscore how careful the Southern Presbyterian Church was in drawing its distinction, before the General Assembly would accept the committee's final report, they added two known premillennialists to the committee to ensure that there was no bias against the premillennial view inadvertently allowed in the report. The Confessional Committee of Seven then submitted its unanimous report against dispensationalism in 1944, including three premillennialists, Samuel Sibley, J.P. McCallie, and L. Nelson Bell. In short, the Presbyterian General Assembly took elaborate measures to ensure that the premillennial view and its implications were represented and understood accurately and fairly in the Confessional Committee. And the Confessional Committee, in turn, took pains to clarify that premillennialism per se was not the problem. So which kind of premillennialism are they saying is not out of step with the Westminster Confession? Historicist premillennialism. Okay, but this kind of what?
It's out of step.
It's out of step, okay? Heresy, it's not in line with the confession. So, the heart of covenant theologians' objection to the position is described as dispensationalism was three... Let me start over. The heart of covenant theology and theologians' objection to the position they describe as dispensationalism was threefold. Number one, dispensationalism taught two ways of salvation. One, a system of legal merit in the Old Testament, and a diametrically different way, grace through faith, in the New Testament. Second, and thus second, misconstructed the Old Testament law as detrimental to Christian faith and life, and three, failed to recognize implications of Christ's current reign by failing to recognize Christ's inauguration of the kingdom through his life, death, and resurrection. So, now, I'm just going to be honest with you. He eventually, at the end of this, takes up with outlining some things about how some dispensationalists tried to respond to this. And one of the things we're going to see in a few weeks is eventually in the 1950s, the idea to revise the Scofield Reference Bible becomes a popular idea. Okay? If you look at the notes that were revised in the Scofield Reference Bible and compare it to the findings of this Creedal Committee of the Southern Presbyterian Church, every single note that the Presbyterian Church identified as being in error was revised by the Revision Committee on the New Scofield Reference Bible. Okay? And interestingly enough, Pastor Stam, as we'll see in a few weeks, takes up the gauntlet with these guys that were responsible for reforming, or revising, I should say, the Scofield Reference Bible, and really, you know, tries to give them a run for their money as far as what they're attempting to do. But we'll talk more specifically about that in a future lesson. Okay. So before we get into the second point I want to make before we close out the hour here, does anybody have any questions, comments, or feedback regarding the dispensational covenantal rift and the official finding of the Presbyterian Church against dispensationalism? Yeah.
So the covenant theologians believe that we are actually in the kingdom right now?
Yes.
Well, it's supposed to be a 1,000-year reign. What do they do with that?
I don't know. But they believe that the kingdom reign of Christ was inaugurated by Christ while he was on earth. Okay? And I will not attempt to be an apologist for the, you know, for this type of historicist premillennialism. But remember, I don't know if you were here, Tom, when we went over this. I think it was before you guys started coming. But you know, we went over how a lot of these guys think we're living in Revelation 19 or Revelation 17 or 18. And they argue about, you know, which chapter we're really in, but they view the entire book of Revelation as different stages in the history of the church. And, you know, so the church is just living through all these things that were inaugurated and started with Christ. And frankly, when we, you know, the other thing too is the whole idea of progressive dispensationalism, which we'll talk more about, and again, I keep saying that, but, you know, we can't talk about everything in every lesson, but the whole idea of progressive dispensationalism is about wedding covenant theology together with dispensational theology. I was in a conversation with somebody just this year who said that his life's career goal was to merge dispensational theology with the teachings of George Eldon Lang. Okay? For the sake of prudency, I'm not going to say who that was right now, but that was the goal of this individual's academic career. Okay, so this progressive stuff is trying to take these things and make them fit together.
There's you mentioned Dallas Seminary. You can see that this as a result of this, there's a downgraded movement. Dallas Seminary today basically does not stand behind dispensationalism at all. In fact, their last president publicly, who's the guy? He's the big radio. Swindle publicly has announced that he won't abide by it. And I don't think it's being taught at all there. So men like Walward and Shaker, they would be having fits right now if they were still alive. But I think it's a downgrade thing that you see. Once it starts, it's hard to stop it.
Yeah. And so now in hindsight, these charts, I think, make a little bit more sense.
Yep.
So why are Presbyterians falling out of the student body and the faculty of Dallas Theological Seminary in 1945? Because in 1944, there was an official church ruling against dispensational theology. So if you were to remain a good Presbyterian, you wouldn't go where? You wouldn't go to Dallas Theological Seminary where they're teaching dispensational theology. Okay? All right, any other comments about that before we get into the second point? So before we leave the 1940s, I thought it would be good to just sort of list out. We don't have time to discuss every single one of these controversies in all their detail, but I just wanted you to be aware of some of the other issues that were going on. So controversy continues. C.R. Stam's The Controversy chronicles the ongoing controversy faced by members of the Grace Movement throughout the 1940s and into the 1950s. It is not our intention to rehash here the totality of these controversies when they are outlined in Pastor Stam's book. Our purpose is just to summarize some of them to round out our summary of the 1940s. Page numbers have been provided for those interested in reading more about each controversy. 1944, August 4, John R. Rice from Wheaton, Illinois, an editor of Sword of the Lord periodical, openly attacks the hyperdispensationalism of O'Hare and Stam. And at the top of the next page is a subpoint to that. Disputes with John R. Rice continued into the 1950s. O'Hare's, the dispensationalism of Dr. E.W. Bollinger, Dr. C.I. Schofield, and Dr. John R. Rice, answer to Rice's answer is evidence of this fact. That booklet is not written until 1953-54. So the disagreements with John R. Rice can extend out beyond the 40s and into the 50s. 1945, Herman Brolin, is that right? Pastor of Hawthorne Gospel Church, a man Stam knew since his childhood, tried to rescue a group of believers from heresy by giving them a copy of O'Hareism. 1946, January, Dr. Keith L. Brooks, editor of Prophecy Monthly, runs an article misrepresenting both the Berean Searchlight and Stam, quote, that we are the exponents of the Bollinger extreme dispensational ideas. And second, that we teach that the Lord's Supper is not for this age. Third, that we teach that church truth is to be found only in the prison epistles of Paul. Four, that we teach that miracles are confined to Peter's ministry as distinct from Paul's. And five, that we teach the Great Commission is Jewish. So if you want it, so Stam in the Controversy explains all these things and lays them out. 1947, January, O'Hare writes a long-winded title called Some Comments on Recent Magazine Articles by Dr. William Pettingill, Dr. Oliver Bushwell, and Dr. F. Williams, and Reverend James R. Graham concerning water baptism. As the title suggests, this booklet addresses the ongoing struggle between the Grace Movement, with fundamentalists over the subject of water baptism. So that dispute, as you well know, did not go away. Also in 1946, in October, Stam writes an article for the Searchlight addressing the publication of a book titled The New Higher Criticism by Dr. James R. Graham. Graham referred to Stam and O'Hare as O'Hare-Stam-Neo-Tubigans? And I don't even know what he's talking about. You familiar with that term, Mike?
No, I just assume he's one of our church.
There was German heretics. There was German higher criticism, attacks against the Bible.
Do you know that name, Pastor Lee?
Yeah.
Okay. And also accused them of being antinomian teachers or anti-law. All right. One of the things that I forgot to add, this is where I wanted to put this. I was given recently an original copy of The Twofold Purpose of God by Stam from the first printing. So we need to add in there, Sylvia, that in June 1947, Stam prints or publishes The Twofold Purpose of God. should be added to that chronology. October 1947, The Voice, the paper of the IFCA, runs an article written by the Religion Analysis Service titled Bullingeristic Ultra-Dispensationalism. This article openly criticized both O'Hare's message, the most wonderful truth in the Bible, and the doctrinal platform of the GGF. O'Hare responded by writing, "Are members of the IFCA responsible for the disgraceful fanaticism of snake-hugging fundamentalists?" Oh, man. I think he was a little upset there. Probably was. Next year, 1947, or next month, sorry, 1947, November, Stam responds to the article in The Voice by the RSA with an article in the Searchlight titled Religion Analysis Service Incorporated, Is It Worthy of Our Confidence? According to Stam, the advisory council of the RAS was comprised of the following notable Bible teachers: Arthur I. Brown, Lewis Berry Chafer, R.V. Clearwaters, Charles L. Feinberg, W.S. Hotel, or Hotel, I don't know how you say it, Harold S. Larsom, and Pettingill, and Lewis Talbot, among others. You should also note that in 1961, the RAS analyzed the Grace Movement again in the July-September issue of the Discerner, the magazine of the RAS. In this article, O'Hareism was characterized as a new garment for the old heresy of Bullingerism. In 1950, Stam runs an article in the Searchlight titled, It Is Time to Stop It, in which he speaks of having received a syllabus from a course on false cults being taught at Omaha Bible Institute. Included on the syllabus was a lesson that dealt with the Grace Gospel Fellowship and pastors J.C. O'Hare and C.R. Stam as propagators of Bullingerism under a new name. So the accusations of Bullingerism basically never stopped. One thing I think that's interesting here, this is to give you some idea of some of the things that O'Hare was up to. This is the Chicago Daily News from Saturday, February 1st, 1947. Okay, this is Chicago Daily News. He took out an entire back page, full page advertisement titled, Neither the UN nor religion can bring peace to this troubled world. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And then he's got, as you can see, a lengthy article here that he paid to print on the back page of the Chicago newspaper. And at the bottom, at the very bottom, it says, North Shore Church, gives the address, it gives the radio broadcast. And then it says, send for the free booklet, The Prince of Peace is Coming. And then he says, look forward to our next full-page Bible message. So he was doing this with regular frequency, taking out this type of advertisement in the Chicago paper and running messages like this in printed form. And it wasn't just in the Chicago Daily News. It was in the other papers that were being circulated in the city at that time. So just another example of the type of things that these men were doing to try to get the message to get the message of grace out there for people to understand. So any questions or comments about any of that? I'm going to be done a little early today if you don't have any questions. So, last point then. A common complaint repeatedly made by O'Hare and Stam and their responses to detractors was that they were being misrepresented. These men are constantly depicted as teaching Bullingerism, quoting with quotes, despite their constant attempts to explain how they differed from Bullinger. Consequently, both O'Hare and Stam viewed their position as never having been fairly and straightly answered by their critics. It's a recurring theme throughout much of the writing that what they perceive to be happening is they are being lumped into a group that is easy from their perspective to attack, and that nobody had ever answered them straightforwardly on their teaching and their teaching alone without pulling one of these sort of argumentative tricks by classifying them as something that they had repeatedly said over and over and over again in print and on the airwaves and any and other mediums, that they were not in agreement with Bullinger about major points of his later teaching. So, consequently, both O'Hare and Stamm viewed their position, as I just said, as never having been fairly and straightly answered by the critics, and any attempt to answer their teaching devolved into accusations of hyper-dispensationalism and personal attacks. Yeah, and again, the other thing that they do consistently and routinely is use the writings of some of these men that they were in agreement with against their own arguments. So, for example, some of the stuff Gabelein wrote in his commentary on Matthew about how Matthew 28 is not for the church. They'll say in their writings, listen, if we're being accused of being heretics and Bullingerites for saying that Matthew 28 is not our commission, why isn't Gabelein? And so they're looking at what they perceive to be fundamental inconsistencies and unfairnesses in how things are being done as sort of indicative of the greater arguments that were going on at the time. All right, so does anybody have any questions or comments about any of this material? So we've covered now, I'm considering us of having covered now up through 1940. So we're gonna have a lesson next week looking at the major events of the 50s. And then as we get into the 60s, is when we're going to look at begin looking at the debates and the arguments within the grace movement that I've been sort of building up to or alluding to over the last couple studies. Okay? So, any questions, comments, anything for the good of the order here? If there isn't, we'll be dismissed about 8 minutes early, which never happens. So, Norm?
I do have one question. If all these people were trying to put down, you know, Stephen O'Hare, couldn't they pick up the writings of Bullinger and the writings of Stamm and O'Hare and actually compare them instead of just accuse them? I don't understand, you know, how they're doing it. And I'm sort of curious, too, you know, Chafer being an Acts 2 person, how did he handle the Presbyterian Church trying to shut him down?
He was upset about it. He viewed it as, and I'm going to make this reading available online, this reading about the dispensational covenantal rift by Mangum. But he was very troubled by it and was not happy about it, and viewed it as a personal attack against himself. And he viewed it as, and this is Mangum's insight, he viewed it as a liberal attack within the movement against, within the Presbyterian Church against himself. But what Mangum points out is, no, it wasn't the liberals within the Presbyterian Church that were attacking him. It was the ultra-super confessional conservatives that didn't like this dispensational premillennialism sowing seeds of division and all this stuff within the Presbyterian Church. So he was definitely offended by it, I think. Lee?
I think it would be interesting whether you're going there or not as you finish this series out, to show some of the distinctive trends within our modern, right now, 2013 trends in the grace movement.
Well, I'm going to do that.
I think that's very important because there are obviously some very serious changes being taken place. One of my friends sat right in my office not long ago and said, he said, we're going to go back to baptizing. He says, it's not because we, it's a, what do you call it? He called it a historical. Has historical significance. And so that's actually being promoted today.
Yeah, I'm going to, when we get to the end, I'm going to talk about some trends and sort of lessons that we should gather from this whole 4 years of what we've been doing. Fred?
Yeah, just observation. A lot of times you hear people talk about being involved in kingdom work and stuff like that. Is that prestige of the historical movement, you think? I mean, of the historical premillennialist movement. They think the kingdom is already in place, so they...
I would say...
Anything that we're doing in the Lord's work today is called kingdom work?
I would say them and anybody that is postmillennial thinking that it's us that ushers in the kingdom age would also, you know, use that sort of terminology. In their conversation, or in the way they describe things, and what they're doing. Okay. Well, I appreciate your attention. Next Sunday, we will traverse into the 50s, look at some things, including the death of O'Hare, as well as some other things about new controversies and things that you need to be aware of from the 50s. So I appreciate your attention. We'll see you next week.